marche à l'envers.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So, we thought France's political crisis couldn't get any crazier, but here we go again. It has. France once again has no government. As of this morning, Prime Minister Michel Barnier has handed in his resignation.
Yeah, Barnier lost a vote of no confidence on Wednesday that was put forward by the left-wing coalition of lawmakers in the National Assembly. They're very unhappy with his austerity budget, which Barnier pushed through using a constitutional measure to basically bypass a vote in Parliament.
Yeah. Barnier now holds the unhappy title of having the shortest tenure of Prime Minister of the Fifth Republic. He was in office for just 3 months, and he was named through a series of negotiations, notably with the far-right National Rally, and then he was ousted when that same party backed the left-wingers to vote him out. Now, some would say maybe we could see this coming. I don't know. The crisis has been looming for some time, but it is still something of a shock. I mean, this is the first time a prime minister has lost a vote of no confidence since 1962.
What happens now? Well, that's anyone's guess. Barnier will stay at the head of a caretaker government until President Macron names a new prime minister. The left, meanwhile, is calling on Macron to resign.
Yeah. Macron is saying there will be a new prime minister before Sunday, when the Notre Dame Cathedral officially opens to the public with great pomp and circumstance.
Will we see him maybe nipping into church for a quick prayer
ahead of time? Who knows?
Sarah, as journalists, we aspire to digging up original stories, don't we? But we also depend on newswires to give us the latest leads, especially about what's happening in far-flung countries.
Yeah. And since we're in France, well, often we're going to the national news agency, the Agence France-Presse, known as AFP.
Yeah, AFP was founded 80 years ago on the 20th of August 1944, just a few days before the liberation of Paris. And it was founded in quite dramatic circumstances. Eight journalists who'd been working underground for the resistance took over the premises of the Havas news agency, which during the occupation had become more or less a mouthpiece for German propaganda. The journalists declared that from then on, the agency would provide independent, verified information for the soon-to-be-liberated France. At that time, there were no female war correspondents.
So like no French equivalent of Lee Miller or Martha Gellhorn?
No, or at least that has always been the official line. It turns out there was at least one, a French-British journalist called Marcel Poirier. She was General de Gaulle's official reporter, filing stories for AFP, notably on his arrival in Paris. And yet, she's been completely erased from the very story she wrote. Until now, Laurent Calfala, a journalist and photo editor at AFP, has made a documentary about this feisty, feminist and forgotten war correspondent. He first saw her name in October last year when he was leafing through a book on the history of AFP, written in the early 1990s.
So I was looking at the book and I found a small picture of a woman wearing an uniform. She was standing in front of a car with Croix de Lorraine, so the symbol from the French Resistance and General de Gaulle. And the caption was saying, 1944, Marcel Poirier from AFP, first French female war correspondent. So I said, well, who is Marcel Poirier? I never heard about her. There was two or three lines in the book saying that she was with de Gaulle when he entered into Paris in August 1944. And she also reported from Adolf Hitler's eagle nest in the Bavarian Alps.
So this was like his headquarters, his refuge.
Yeah, it was his refuge in the Alps. So I gave a call to former journalists from at least 80 years old and saying, have you met Marcel Poirier? And he was saying, no, who was she? So nobody knew about her.
Laurent Calfala began digging into AFP's extensive archives, but it was complicated. Most agency journalists signed with their initials, not their full name, and some of the archives from 1944 had been lost. He then started trawling through AFP's in-house magazines.
Nothing about Marcel Poirier. A lot about all the men who came from London, and that, but nothing about a woman. At one point, I say, okay, maybe she never existed. There's something wrong there.
So he turned to the archives of the BNF, France's National Library, and finally began to find articles by Poirier from 1944 and 45. One in particular convinced him that she was no ordinary journalist.
I was really blown away. It was dated September 1944, so a few weeks after Paris was liberated, and only 5 months after the French women got the right to vote, and the article was titled something like Equal in Heroism, Women Will Now Play a Major Role in French Politics. So I said, wow, Marcel Poirier, yeah, she was somebody. Also, I said, wow, she managed to publish something like this at AFP, which was very good. So I started to search to understand who she was, what she has done.
The internet was a dead end. There were several Marcel Poirier, but the woman linked to de Gaulle had disappeared. And yet Calfala couldn't believe that she wouldn't have written her story somewhere.
She was a journalist, so I was almost sure that she wrote something about her story. That's part of the history. I mean, de Gaulle entering to Paris, that's one of the major things for France for the 20th century. So I said, for sure she wrote something.
He discovered she'd been married to a Welsh journalist who'd been AFP's bureau chief in Beijing, Hong Kong, and then Sydney. So he began looking in Asia. And in December 2023, he finally found her story in a publication in Australia.
I found an article written by Marcel Poirier for the 40th anniversary of the liberation of Paris in a newspaper, and she was telling all her story. And the story was amazing.
Poirier was half British, half French, and grew up in Leeds in the UK. She worked as a journalist in both France and England, in both languages. When France capitulated to Germany in 1940, she took the last boat out of Le Havre and returned to Leeds to work for the well-respected Yorkshire Post. A few days after D-Day, she rallied to de Gaulle's Free French Movement and began working with the general in London as head of the press office for the Free French. In August 1944, as de Gaulle was preparing to return to France via Algiers, three French war correspondents left London to join him. But there was a problem.
After 3 or 4 days, the information came back to London that their car, their jeep, had been found
empty
and with dark stain on the seats.
Red.
So probably they were killed. So that was a big problem for the French forces because de Gaulle was going to enter Paris and it was impossible to send British or American journalists with him. They needed a French journalist. Marcel Poirier was the only journalist there. And so the French forces wanted to get the accreditation for her to be a war correspondent. And the British and the Americans said, no, she's a woman, so she can't go on the front line. So they decided to send Marcel without any
official
role. She was just a French officer and she was smuggled in France to join de Gaulle. And as soon as she arrived in France, she was arrested by the military police because they couldn't understand what a woman was doing there with a French uniform, and she couldn't exactly explain what she was going to do.
They put her in a nunnery in Bayeux. She managed to escape, to get a lift in a truck, and basically got to join de Gaulle, followed him in this truck. So she was in Brittany with him, then Normandy, and then finally entering into Paris. So all of this she tells in this amazing article that you managed to land on the other side of the world in Australia. And maybe a couple of things which really stuck in your mind?
The first thing is she's telling a lot of things about de Gaulle because she was following him. And she was telling that he was crying and things like this. One thing which is quite funny also, when he goes to Chartres, so he starts to talk to the people there and he lost his voice. So the doctor said, you have to rest. And he said, no way. So it was a lot of personal thing about de Gaulle. There was a lot of people in the
sure.
cortege.
Huh?
She was not alone. But she was a woman and she was telling the things differently. I think that's the thing. Yeah? She was talking about de Gaulle like a man, very human.
Calfala and his archive team managed to find the first AFP story of de Gaulle's arrival in Paris with the initials MP at the bottom. So most probably Marcel Poirier. After the liberation, she continued working for AFP, and in 1945 she became one of its official war correspondents, and for the Yorkshire Post too. She had a singular style, she was drawn to the human story, had an eye for detail, and a focus on women.
She followed the French troops to Germany, and she went to Hitler's Eagle Nest. She went to Vienna, she went to Trieste in Italy, and I found quite a few articles about women. She was really telling the life of German women, of the French resistance also.
Including German women who were like forced into prostitution.
Yeah, that was in Vienna. In Vienna, she wrote an article which is really moving about how people are getting into prostitution just to get a little bit of food and nobody cares. And I think she describes Germany and Austria in a very human way, which is also the case from other women war correspondents. Because there were many women war correspondents. Apparently, on the 500 war correspondents at the landing in Normandy, there was something like almost 200 women. But they were in the back, in the hospitals. They were not on the front line. So they had the human stories. But the difference is that Marcel Poirier was on the front line. That was the thing. Yeah.
So she was still producing very, very interesting journalism in, well, 1945 in particular. And then somehow the line went dead. What happened, Laurent?
That's a big question for me. So in 1945, so she goes to Germany. She writes this article, which I like very much, about Eva Braun. She went to the house that Hitler bought for her, and she talks with the majordom, or you say the butler of Hitler, who tells about Eva Braun and so on. And then after 1946, I couldn't find anything. Nothing in newspapers, nothing in AFP archives. So 1947, nothing. And suddenly, I found two articles in a women's magazine. And then there was a story about, ladies, tomorrow you will stop doing the dishwashing, the new machines which will arrive. Yeah. You say, okay, what are you talking about, Marcel? In fact, it's a bit feminist also, because she said that the inventions, the new things which were invented, shouldn't go to build weapons and things like this, but should be put to the...
To help women in the home.
Exactly. But that's a bit weird. After reporting on all these stories, why did she work for women's magazine?
So what's your theory?
Well, the three men who disappeared at the beginning of the story with their jeep, in fact, they were not killed, and blood was not blood, it was wine.
So those three guys came back, they hadn't died, and they took their old jobs back.
Yeah, the men took the power at AFP, like everywhere. So I think Marcel Poirier was a bit pushed away, at least...
Sidelined.
Yes, yeah, sidelined, and some of them become directors and so on. Yes, and we know their story. Mm. But the name of Marcel Poirier is nowhere, except in that book of 1992.
There was the trace, the picture, and the caption saying war correspondent, and yet nobody ever followed up on it.
Yes, she was not forgotten, because there's this trace in the book. So that's even worse. She was not forgotten, but nobody cared. That's the thing.
So, Alison, here's a question. Why did it take Poirier 40 years to write her own story, even if it was just in a short newspaper article?
Yeah. Good question. And Laurent Calfala has wondered the same thing. Poirier had no children, so far he hasn't been able to track down any family members. But his research continues. He's planning a sequel and hoping that, thanks to the documentary, people who knew her or of her will come forward.
So the Notre Dame Cathedral reopens to the public this weekend. The Gothic church in the center of Paris has been closed since April 15, 2019, when a huge fire destroyed much of the wooden and metal roof and toppled the spire.
Yeah, seeing it go up in smoke like that was traumatizing for a lot of French people and foreigners. You know, those images were broadcast around the world.
Yeah, so Notre Dame, like all of France's cathedrals, belongs to the state. And President Emmanuel Macron promised it would be restored within 5 years of the fire. Mm-hmm. And after huge fundraising and renovation efforts, he's only just slightly overshot that deadline.
The cathedral's been rebuilt as it was at a cost of 700 million euros. Some 860 million was raised overall through donations from individuals and companies around the world. Americans were the biggest foreign donors. The foundation of Notre Dame, which is in charge of the money, says that those funds have been well used. We have to believe them on that. There has, however, been some controversy over the cost, whether all that money should be spent on a building, however beautiful, when state coffers are empty and public services are being cut.
Yeah. And there's also been disagreement over whether people could be charged even a small entry fee to help with much needed renovation of other churches in France. The French Catholic Church has been resolutely opposed to charging people to visit a place of worship. So that probably won't happen.
Macron visited the cathedral last week, so we got to see a few pictures of the inside with these, amazing pristine white walls. He described the blaze as a national wound, and all the people that had contributed to the restoration with their labour and their donations as the remedy.
Now, I actually haven't been down to the cathedral in a while, but our colleague, Olia Horton, went down recently, and she described what she saw.
To be honest, I thought there's going to be less scaffolding, there'll be more room to move. Not the case at all. It's still very much shut down from the outside. You can, of course, admire things from a distance. For example, the spire, there's the new cross and the rooster right up the top. But the grand reopening this weekend is more about showing, I think, the progress of the refurbishment inside the cathedral. But as we know, the works both on the inside and the outside still have quite a way to go. And the area is still really a hive of activity. I mean, there's cranes everywhere, there's lifts going up and down, there's workers all over the rooftop, it looks like ants.
Following the fire, Olia, President Macron, you know, he committed, didn't he, to getting Notre Dame rebuilt in 5 years. He's not too far off the timeline. So there is a lot of cause for celebration, and loads of dignitaries have been invited to witness the big unveiling, right?
Exactly. President Macron really set himself a very ambitious deadline, but it does seem like he's going to be able to pull it off for the most part. He's no doubt certainly looking forward to his name being forever connected and remembered as the president who saved Notre Dame. It will certainly draw the attention away from all the tense political situations and conversations and negotiations that his government is facing at the moment.
Notre Dame gives Macron kind of a chance, to sort of move away from all the politics and identify with a more popular cause.
Yes, and the reopening is in fact happening in two phases. There'll be the first part on Saturday, which is really the official event, the inaugural morning mass, which is not open to the public. There'll be over 100 special guests. The list is really being kept under wraps. We just know that Pope Francis is not coming, but we did learn this week that US President-elect Donald Trump will be present, as will US First Lady Jill Biden. She's representing Joe Biden. And the second phase is on the Sunday with two more solemn religious celebrations.
So, Olia, the reopening of the cathedral, it's not just good news for the president. Local residents are also heaving a sigh of relief, I guess. We reported back on this in 2019, how people who live and work nearby were impacted very negatively by the fire and then the shutdown. You've been talking to other locals this week.
Yes. The last 5 years have been quite a strain for the small business owners in the area. They thrive off the tourist trade. They all said, look, the tourists didn't just disappear. Of course, there was the COVID period. But in terms of the flow of tourists, there were always a lot of tourists coming. But the closure of the cathedral, it just meant that everything slowed down a lot. So these people I spoke to, they've been hobbling along and they're really looking forward to business picking up again. Christine, for example, she's been running the Auberge Notre Dame restaurant for 40 years. It's across the river, so it looks across to Notre Dame. She says the customer numbers have dropped considerably in the last 5 years, but especially around the Christmas period, because she said people come in to see the nativity scene, they come in for the Christmas mass, but she's seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Maintenant, je pense qu'ils vont revenir, Ne serait-ce que déjà les groupes, j'ai mes groupes de personnes.
She thinks that the people will start to return. They've already started a little bit. She said bookings are picking up, especially for groups from March through to May. So that's the spring period here. Elderly tourists, for example, groups who often go to the exhibition nearby, they go to the restaurant and then they visit Notre Dame. So she's looking forward to these visitors coming back. We've also got Françoise. She runs a bookstall on the edge of the Seine River. You know, the ones, the little green boxes that they open up.
The Bouquiniste.
Overlooking beautiful view of Notre Dame. And she's been there at that particular spot for 54 years. She's still seen just as many tourists, I mean, give or take the COVID period.
Les gens passaient, mais les gens se faisaient quand même prendre en photo avec les échafaudages et tout ça.
There's always lots of people passing through there. They stop and take pictures. So she's had a very good view of this construction site. She's been taking pictures herself. She's described the cathedral like an insect caught in a web because of all the cranes and the scaffolding all perched around it.
Alors, je suis athée. Je ne crois pas en Dieu.
She also said that she was not religious, but Notre Dame has a special place in her heart. It's a symbol of the history of Paris. It's a whole lot of things that go well above and beyond a religious symbol.
So, Aliyah, Notre Dame is, you know, being unveiled back open. Obviously, a lot still going on, not exactly back to how it was before anytime soon, right?
Yeah, that's right. As I mentioned earlier, there are still a few things to be done, fitting the stained glass windows, replacing the sacristy. And then there's the forecourt, the area, the pedestrian area around the front of the cathedral. They're going to plant a lot of trees there. There's going to be a new visitor centre with a parking lot underneath for tourist buses and so on. And all of this, I think, is supposed to be wrapping up around 2027. But as you can see, you know, 800 years on, Notre Dame is still getting yet another facelift.
Je bois systématiquement pour oublier les amis de ma femme. Je bois systématiquement pour oublier tous mes emmerdements.
So, Allison, let's talk wine. There's this trend in French wines that are becoming more and more alcoholic. Mm. So what used to be 11, 12 degrees alcohol today is pushing 14, 15 degrees. I believe you have noticed this. You're actually the one who put me onto this subject.
Yeah, my extensive investigations into wine. Yeah, it's becoming harder to find lighter wines, especially in supermarkets. Mm-hmm. You now increasingly have to go to specialist shops and pay a bit more.
Yeah. So the reason has a lot to do with climate change. So hotter summers means less water. The fruits, the grapes in this case, have more concentrated sugar. And a sugar, of course, is what turns into alcohol during the winemaking process.
So we have more alcoholic wines at a time when more and more people are turning away from alcohol.
Yeah.
Drinking a bit less, maybe drinking more beer, mm-hmm. soft drinks for health reasons or whatever.
Yeah. So this makes it tricky for winemakers. I went to the Independent Winemakers Fair in the south of Paris last week to see what they're saying. This is a twice annual fair that brings over 600 winemakers to Paris, draws thousands of visitors, wine lovers, or just people want to have a look or a drink.
Donc du coup, on avait dit Kéran, Rasto et Mourvèdre, c'est ça?
C'est s'il vous plaît.
Donc du coup, le Kéran. Donc là, on est sur la cuvée classique, entre guillemets. Parce qu'on
Martin Le Poutre is pouring out a sample of a Kéran wine from the southern Rhône region. He works with his girlfriend on her family's vineyard, the Domaine Rabas-Charavin. He explains that the southern region has always had hot summers, but increasing temperatures have pushed grape harvests earlier and has made for sweeter grapes, which yields more alcohol.
With the climate change and everything, like maybe 20 years ago where we were more around 13 degrees of alcohol. But today it's difficult for us to be under 13 degrees, but we are more around 14, 15 and trying not to go too much over that.
You can't always taste a 1 to 2 degree difference in alcohol, he says, especially if the wine is made well, if it's well balanced. But customers are increasingly concerned about higher alcohol and what they're drinking.
Sometimes they are asking, so how much alcohol is in this one? I'm saying like, okay, it's 15. So they are like, they seem like in the middle of a nightmare. But actually, I'm trying to explain, like, if you have one glass of this Kéran, for example, which is 15, actually, and a glass of this one, which is 13 and a half, you're not really going to feel like if you had a bottle of each, you will be in the same state, actually. I'm trying to explain. It's like we have to find the right balance between this alcohol, the acidity. The alcohol is just part of the wine. Et donc, du coup, Rasto, pareil, c'est la cuvée donc, classique, traditionnelle, entre guillemets.
Et du coup, la base d'un Rasto, c'est quoi? C'est la grenache?
C'est la base, la base des vins du Rhône méridional.
Le Poutre explains the different grape varieties in the wines to Pierre, a regular visitor to this annual wine fair. Pierre is asking about the grapes and the region, but not the alcohol, though it is something he says he and his girlfriend do pay attention to when they're buying wine.
On regarde quand même le taux d'alcool quand on achète un nouveau vin.
We do look at the alcohol content when we buy things, he says, because we don't really like too much alcohol. Red wines are going up to 15 degrees, and you can feel it, he says. It's not necessarily the main thing we look at, but it's something to consider.
The higher the degree of alcohol, the taste is more like alcohol. Sometimes it can be tricky also. Sometimes, wow, it feels sweet, but when you take a look at the alcohol degree, wow, suddenly it's very higher than you expected.
Maël is another regular visitor to the fair, though more as a taster than as a buyer.
I'm more red wine, especially for dinner. But yeah, I drink all kinds of wines, and especially for sparkling wines, now the alcohol degree tends to be higher than it used to. Definitely. Champagne or other sparkling wine, Cremant. In my mind, it was like around 12 degrees, but now it's more like 14, sometimes 15 degrees. So it's not so much, but still it matters when you drink three glasses. If wine is has a higher alcoholic degree, I try to drink less of it, but the taste is more important than the absolute alcohol degree.
Donc voici donc la cuvée Alchimie donc un Châteauneuf du Pape Rouge sur le millésime 2021.
Ludovic Cellier pours out a taste of his Châteauneuf du Pape wine grown in southeastern France.
On constate depuis quelques décennies une petite augmentation du taux.
Over the last few decades, we've noticed a slight increase in the level of alcohol due to climate change and global warming. But wine growers have also started letting grapes mature longer to develop their fruitiness and rich colors.
Que la maturité phénolique soit vraiment à son optimal.
So the phenolic acid really develops. We've learned how to do this from previous generations. To wait for the right maturity.
So summers are hotter, making sweeter grapes that create more alcohol, sure. But winemakers like Cellier are also reviving techniques that mean that the sugars and flavors are more concentrated. His wife, Nathalie Cellier, who manages customers for the vineyard, says that she gets a lot of questions about alcohol content.
Yeah, they're looking more and more low degrees.
She's a bit skeptical of this, and she encourages people to taste the wines first before dismissing them for being too high in alcohol.
For our wines, mostly people are tasting the wines and they are thinking that the wine is generous. And when they are looking for the degrees, they say, oh, the degrees is too high. But this generosity for the wines is also due of high degrees, because alcohol gives smoothness and feelings of sweetness.
It's part of the flavor.
Yeah, that's right. But when you are in the supermarket, you cannot taste the wines. And sometimes people think that if they are buying lower degrees on the wines, it will be better. But sometimes it's not true.
So there is this inherent tension with alcohol and wine. It's part of the taste, but it's also what's affecting people's health and why it's become such a concern. Caroline Boursier, who grows grapes on her family's land in the Blaye Côte de Bordeaux region, says there are different ways to try to limit alcohol in wines these days.
One way is to harvest a bit earlier to reduce the alcohol content a bit. But that means the grapes are not always particularly mature. Or we can change varieties. Our wines are made with mainly Merlot grapes. Some varieties handle heat better, so they'll yield wines with different alcohol content.
But not all the wines can swap varieties. Boursier says her wines are made with Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon. There are strict rules about what kind of grapes can be grown where to get an appellation, to call a wine a Bordeaux or a Burgundy, for example. Another method to lower alcohol is just to remove it. Boursier makes a wine called Faut pas pousser Georgette dans les orties, don't push Georgette into the nettles. It's a play on the expression pousser mémé dans les orties, pushing grandma into the nettles, which means pushing the limits.
We've lowered the alcohol content in this wine, but not completely. It's 9 degrees, a white wine. We had requests from customers who wanted a lighter wine that was easier to drink. It's surprising the things customers ask for, but it's up to us to adapt. After all, the idea is for them to buy it.
The process of removing alcohol is more than just evaporation, though. It's a process that involves equipment, and it's not what she wants to be doing full time.
We don't want to go off into an alcohol-free frenzy. We're wine producers. We make alcohol. We can make grape juice for kids, and we do that. But making something with no alcohol at all is not how we want to work.
Doing wine without alcohol, it's like not really part of the wine, actually, and the culture that we are trying to go with. We don't really want to go in this business.
Martin Lepoutre says wines from the Côte du Rhône region are allowed to remove some degrees of alcohol.
The classical Côte du Rhône, we are allowed to take off some alcohol, but the maximum is a degrees or degrees and a half. And some big sellers have the equipment and everything, which are really expensive, actually.
Instead, he and his girlfriend are sticking with the alcohol content they have, even if it's going up, and focusing instead on making what he calls more elegant wines.
Back in the day, the wine from South Rhone was known for the power and the texture, a lot of tannin and everything. So we were extracting a lot of tannin, a lot of color. Today, we still have this alcohol, but trying to not extract too much tannin and everything, to have something more on the fruit or more fresh, because the market and the customer are asking today for some lighter wine. Lighter in the aromas, and then we are trying to do like this. They are coming lighter because of the extraction that we are doing and trying to do something easy to drink. Est-ce que vous voulez goûter encore quelque chose?
Je pense que ça ira parce que.
Ouais.
Je vous remercie pour toutes les explications. Ce monde est fou.
Ah. That's it for Spotlight on France. We're a production of Radio France International.
This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani. If you want to send us a message, please do. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
And we are on Instagram, Spotlight on France. Do find and subscribe to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or any podcast app. Please consider rating and reviewing us. We'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time on Thursday, the 19th of December. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison. Mm-hmm.